the government calls that a genetic bottleneck, but I call it a recipe for complete and utter destruction of crucial building blocks for the cannabis community and for the cannabis plant's genetic diversity. So I definitely agree with Paul on that.
In this episode, I talk with Paul Lewin and Jack Lloyd, who are both cannabis and psychedelics lawyers and activists based in Toronto. We talk about their paths to becoming lawyers, their views on medical cannabis issues, their cases on behalf of medical patients, and many other political and legal issues related to cannabis and psychedelics.
Welcome both to the podcast.
Oh, pleased to be here.
Excellent.
Thanks, man. Yeah, awesome to be here.
I've been following you guys in your careers for quite a while, and I'm so excited to have both of you on to talk with me today about cannabis law and all things related, and maybe stray into some non-cannabis law areas as well. You're both so very well established, long-time criminal defense cannabis lawyers, but you're also activists. You guys are both on the leading edge, and when I take a look at all the things you have been doing, it makes me feel like I'm not doing enough. And that's how I describe you guys, but is that how you describe yourself? I mean, Paul, how would you describe your law practice? How do you describe yourself as a lawyer?
That's very flattering. Thank you for the kind words. And I used to say I'm a cannabis lawyer, and now I'm a lawyer with a focus on cannabis and psychedelics. Previously a criminal lawyer, I've kind of tried to adapt to this new world in which it may be a little less criminal court and a little more compliance work. So we've tried to evolve with that. But I love the way you put it, Russell. I can't complain with that.
Excellent. And Jack, what about you? How would you describe yourself as a lawyer?
I think I'm a cannabis and psychedelics lawyer. I think that's a great way to describe it. Certainly, my career has been greatly influenced by Paul, who I worked for a long time and articled for. So I take my guidance from Paul, you know. So I'm just honored to work with him and to practice law in such an exciting and interesting area.
So psychedelics, just to veer off into that for a second, Jack, well, how did you decide to expand from cannabis into psychedelics? And what does that actually mean in terms of your practice?
So for me, psychedelics, so I got into sort of the space as an activist many years ago, and then I worked in the cannabis industry for many years as the cultivation and genetics editor of Green Candy Press, which is the world's largest publisher of books about the cannabis plant. And I was very passionate about that and did that for many years and still
that's great. Let me just stop you there for a second. So Green Candy Press, and you're an editor there. I see that on your Twitter feed, and that's one of the things that you do or did. And go back to the before that. How did cannabis enter your life? Where was the inciting incident, if you will, for you and cannabis together?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I come from a community where the vast majority of people were growing cannabis, and that sparked a deep connection to and interest in the cannabis plant. And that was an interest that was certainly back then not so publicly something that you would share publicly. And then I began interacting publicly with the cannabis plant around 2009 when I started editing books about how to grow it. So that was pretty much it. And then psilocybin. Since 2011, I wanted to do a book about psilocybin mushrooms, and I tried to find someone to write it, because in 2011, the last book about psilocybin mushrooms that had been published was, I think, a 2002 release from Ed Rosenthal, which was really just repackaging some McKenna materials. And so nobody had done a book about psilocybin mushrooms. And at that time, there was this big revolution around PFTech and agar use and essentially these novel cultivation techniques that you could just do in your house really easily. You didn't need industrial stuff. You didn't need professional sanitization and inoculation machines. Right. You could just do it yourself in your apartment. Right. And this revolution emerged, and I was trying to document it, and I was desperate to document it, and I simply couldn't make it happen. And I tried to do it until I finally did it in 2015. So in 2015, I found a mycologist that could do the book, and we did the book, and that was called the Psilocybin Mushroom Bible. That has since become the best-selling book about psilocybin mushrooms on the market, step-by-step photos teaching you how to grow it, et cetera. And then subsequent to that, we did the Psilocybin Chef cookbook, which is just a cookbook teaching people consumption methodology for psilocybin. And so that was a big passion project for me for a long time, creatively, editorially. And I'm just thrilled that my law practice has been able to follow that. So that was, sorry that I interrupted you. That was
no, not at all.
I get very passionate about that.
This is great. I love the interrupting, and there's no, just to set the ground rules for this chat, there are no ground rules. Okay. So feel free to dive in, jump in, interject at any time. I'm a fan of that. So, I'm going to try and bring you back though, because you can't drop a bomb. Like, I grew up where cannabis was being grown and not expect me to go back there. Can you talk a bit about, what that meant? Where can you talk about where you were, or is this all like classified information?
I just don't think that's the fun part of our chat, man. I'm not super into diving too deep into that.
Paul, you have an origin story with cannabis and why you became so passionate about speaking out against the prohibition?
So I did. I was just a your ordinary pot smoker, beer drinker for a long time, and it was in my early 30s, and an activist who used to be fairly widely known in Toronto, known as Doc, and he told me that he said, you know, Paul, like, you're a lawyer, and this is really a special thing you've got here, and you should be using this to try and do some good. Like, don't be just taking any old case, like, try and make things better. And he sort of dragged me into activism. And that was in 1999. So I was in my early 30s. I kind of always just shrugged about cannabis. Like, oh, well, what are you going to do? Like, it's a crime and it makes no sense, but what are you going to do? And so I got involved in 99. In 2000, I ran for the marijuana party in the federal election, and I was the Toronto coordinator.
That's amazing.
The Trinity Spadina riding. And someone had donated this fantastic, gigantic, it was like a woman's clothing store, a large woman's clothing store on Queen West in Parkdale, and all sorts of crazy folks, as you'd imagine. And at that time, the idea of a marijuana party was just like, that was crazy. And yes. All kinds of kooky, but good-hearted, hardworking activists became a part of this thing. And so that's, I guess, the 99, a friend dragging me in saying, wake up and do something good with your lawyer status, and then getting involved with the party. So.
And what was the reception of your party like? How did people receive it?
Well, we got a fair bit of press for a while. We had a couple of press conferences. I remember having a press conference. So I was supposed to find a place. The national leader, Boris St. Maurice from Montreal, was coming in, and we were going to introduce various candidates. And I was the Toronto coordinator, so I was supposed to oversee this. And I remember going across to Jack, what's the name of that place that Robin runs, the Friendly Stranger?
Yes.
And he would not. So it's a cannabis store on Queen West. and he would not allow us to have the press conference at the Friendly Stranger.
Oh,
and,
no.
You know, I hear this guy talk about him and his activist, like he was just, and so I ended up actually across the street. I went to the Beverly a lot. I don't know, long time Toronto drinkers might remember the Beverly. It's gone now. And they were like, sure, yeah, no problem. So the bar across the street would have it, but the cannabis store wouldn't.
And oh, you know, hilarious. Paul, that they're now like, that's like a massive cannabis chain now.
The Friendly Stranger, that's right, yes. Do you consider yourself still to be an activist, Paul?
I don't know.
Now that legalization, you know, legalization's hits away, you know, is there any more need for activism?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, there are lots of unjust things about the industry. I think they're gradually changing for the better. So the bad things that exist are evolving into better things. And the main bad thing is the fact that when the legal industry was created in 2013, there were a lot of obstacles to cannabis people getting into the industry. And so that's slowly changing. A lot of people may hate Doug Ford, but I'll tell you, he crushed it in terms of retail in Ontario. Mm-hmm. And I remember during the election, what's his name, who had the scandal right before the election? What was the, before Doug Ford, who was it? Current mayor of Brampton.
Patrick Brown.
Oh, didn't do a thing Brown. About the Kathleen Wynne plan for liquor That's stores right. for cannabis.
Yeah.
And that would have been a terrible model. And it's, you know, it's funny because once we get something, it's really hard to undo it, whether it's right or wrong. And like, and you'd think a right-wing party, and I'm a bit of a lefty, but anyway, I'm straying a bit from your original question. I don't know how much I am of an activist these days, to be honest. I do. So, yeah, I'm not sure I'm much of an activist these days.
And what do you think of the marijuana party today? Is there still, there's still a marijuana party, isn't there?
You know, I'm not even sure there is. I mean, the need for a whole party around this doesn't seem to make much sense to me. Certainly, when it was a criminal matter, that made sense. But I don't know if it makes much sense now.
Fair enough. And let's rewind a bit, guys, because I know Jack, you articled with Paul, but maybe can you tell me a bit about how you found Paul and why you wanted to work with him and what articling was like for you?
Oh, sure. So I found Paul. We did a book by a guy named Matthew Murnau, who Paul represented in a very well-known case. Matthew introduced me to Paul. And I think part of it as well is that I had been working at Green Candy Press for so long, and they said that I should volunteer with a cannabis organization. So I started volunteering with an organization that Paul remains a huge figure in, although he's no longer an active, or I'll let Paul talk about that, but that Paul was a big part of Normal Canada, the national organization for the reform of marijuana laws in Canada. And so I started volunteering there, and that sparked a deep interest in the law. And then I became a lawyer.
You became a lawyer from working, from volunteering with Normal?
Correct, yeah.
So you didn't grow up and think, you know, one day I'm going to be a lawyer?
No, I never even considered it. So I started thinking, oh, actually, I could probably be more useful to my community as a lawyer than as a book editor. And that was inspired by Paul Paul and John Conroy and Kirk Tustoff. So I'm just so lucky that all these idols of mine then became like colleagues and friends. It's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. And so you worked with Kirk after Paul. And what was your experience? So you, did you go to BC or where you're able to practice all across the country? I'm assuming that you have permissions from each law society to work across the country. Is that how it works?
Well, there's an interjurisdictional mobility agreement for the purpose of practicing law. TUSA hired me after, so I finished articling for Paul and then I hung my shingle. So I just became my own lawyer. And Paul told me I should look into, you know, helping Kirk on files. So I did. And then Kirk hired me. So then I started working for Kirk. And I worked for Kirk until he retired. And then I took over his practice. And here I am.
And did you, so when you're working with Kirk, were you involved with the Owen Smith case?
No, that was, so that finished in 2015. The ruling was released from the Supreme Court of Canada. And I was called to the bar. Oh, I'm so, June 2016. So Smith had just come out.
To the next year, right. Okay. You also, you said you worked with John Conroy as well?
Certainly, yeah. Just on some, I guess I can't discuss too much, but I share an office with John in BC.
Okay. Were you involved with the Allard case at all?
No, I'm way too junior. So Allard is 2013. It starts with its ruling coming August 24, 20. Early 2016, I think the ruling came out, but
2016, that's right.
But I was only called to the bar in June of 2016, so I'm not part of any of that that stuff. The only case that I think would be considered significant is the case is Howell that Paul had the kindness to have me work on with.
Let's jump into Howell then, because that I think that's a good segue to both of you working together on this case in Alberta, where you are able to put in front of the judge the legacy of the medical case law in Canada, from all the way from Parker to Allard and Allard, and really inform the judge. This judge, and this is Justice Grasser, with a very convenient name to the case. Maybe could you, Paul, kind of give me the background of Mr. Howell and what he was doing and why he needed your help?
Sure. Sean Howell had been applying to be a licensed producer, and his application, like many people who had applied, it really was just going nowhere. It was just sitting in a filing cabinet somewhere, and he was really baffled why that was. He knew a number of people who needed help, and so he started growing to help people. Primarily, it was his partner who had serious health issues. Her daughter, Sean's stepdaughter, Maya, has a very severe form of epilepsy. We've met her. She's a lovely girl, just a shining light. And when you see the family around her, it's amazing, the terrific interaction they have with her. But she has a very, very, essentially, she is having seizures 24/7. And so she needs a significant amount of cannabis, and she wouldn't be able to smoke a joint. And if you bought that government diluted oil, that's not going to do it. She needs a fair bit of cannabinoids in her system. So he was helping her, and there were a few other people. There was a homeless guy.
How old was his stepdaughter?
She was maybe at the time of the kid, maybe 11
okay.
or 12 so, when the charges happened.
Okay. And sorry to interrupt you. You said there's other people too. There's a homeless man as well.
Homeless gentleman who couldn't afford to buy any himself, and he had various issues. There was another woman, Lisa Kirkman, a activist who he was helping, and She had a whole bunch of issues. There's like 100 different reasons she needed medical cannabis. And she was, I mean, at times she was homeless too. And he was giving the cannabis to these people. And they trusted him. He could extract with CO2 extraction, so he wasn't using solvents. It was ideal for, and I mean, this wasn't hundreds of people. There were less than 10, and they were all so grateful for his help. He didn't get a penny from them. And of course, he got charged and was facing serious jail time for helping, for giving away medicine and growing medicine for people. Now, Sean felt in a misguided way, he thought this was going to help him with his LP application. I mean, that's clearly wrong. Sean will readily admit that, like, he misunderstood some of the signals coming from Health Canada. But the bottom line was, this guy was, it was like a Morgenthaler of cannabis. And of course, they wanted to put him in jail for a long time. So that's the background to Sean.
And so what was your strategy for his defense, and how did you, I mean, the decision is 103 pages. It's a massive decision. What did you think would be the best way to approach helping Sean?
So we went hard after, we went after a number of issues. So the obvious one was the oil that he provided to Maya, that really, and we had experts who said that if you tried to drink the diluted oil enough to make a difference for Maya, you could end up actually hurting her, in which she'd risk choking if you tried to force all that liquid down her throat. And so we challenged that arbitrary limit, in which they just said, all right, we're capping it at this. And really, there was no explanation given at any point why it needed to be capped at that. And so we challenged that. We challenged the grow ratio. So the grow ratio, as it stood then and as it still stands, it's one grower can grow for two patients, and you can have a maximum of four licenses at one address. And so for someone like Sean and his partner, Sean's very good at doing this. And so why can't he grow for himself, his partner, and his very sick daughter? And the law prevents that from happening. And so essentially you'd have to have, Sarah would have to have one of the licenses. Sarah at one point went to see her sick mother. This was in Alberta. She went back to Ontario to visit her mother, and all her plants died. Sean, by law, is not allowed to assist Sarah with those plants. He can't water them, or he'd risk going to jail for illegal production. So we said that's wrong. And I think any right thinking person would agree that's wrong. And then we also challenged the fact that you can't access, medical cannabis patients can't access their medicine in person on demand. We said that when you walk out of a store, when you walk out of your doctor's office with a prescription in your hand, you should be able to go to the pharmacy next door and get it as soon as you need it, just the way it is with everything else, every other type of medicine in Canada, everything from echinacea to Oxycontin, you get on demand. And we have this crazy upside down system where, in fact, a 20-year-old heading out for his Friday night party, he picks up his case of beer and his bag of weed. That guy gets it when he needs it. But the sick grandmother stricken with arthritis, she can't go in that. Or the grandfather who's got terrible Crohn's disease and is in terrible pain, they have to wait and order online is what they're supposed to do. And that's still the way it is today. It makes no sense at all. So anyway, those were the three things that we went after.
And what was Justice Grasser's reaction to your defense?
Well, you know what? Like, I have to say, and like, there's things in his judgment, and it's a big judgment. And he said a lot of things, so there are things we take exception to. So I'm not going to pretend I love everything, but like, he spent a lot of time trying to get this right. There's things I disagree with, but I mean, by and large, if all judges took like this world and all these regulations, if you're not in it it's a whole lot of kind of obscure information to have to digest, which, I mean, for an average judge who one day is a murderer and the next day it's a breach of contract, to have to spend a couple of months learning every obscure pot regulation and a whole bunch of obscure pot facts is kind of a pain in the butt. And many judges don't have the intellectual vigor to take it on and to write a proper judgment. I've seen terrible judgments from lazy judges, but this judge was not lazy. He was a smart guy who did the heavy lifting. And he was mostly receptive, I would say. That's my long way of saying he was mostly receptive.
Right. And is Sean finding relief now from your efforts, or where is it now?
He's not. Oh, by the way, I think it's Grazer, not Grasser.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, that's
there's two S's, so I thought it'd be a Grasser. But anyway, okay. Well, Justice Grazer did not give Sean any relief.
Yeah, no, we did not succeed on remedy. I think that was wrong. I was a little bit. Anyway, it wasn't, that was wrong, really. And the test is, in Schachter, the Supreme Court of Canada set out the test. There was a recent big case on remedy about 6 months ago, but it essentially reiterated that Schachter is the law. And Schachter says that the court can't read down or read in. In other words, the court can't fix things if they're not certain that that's what the legislature would have done. And so what he did on the fact that cannabis patients can't access it in person was, he said, well, I'm gonna read in a little bit and read down a little bit and essentially create a system where you could attend in person, but these facilities, they're built on the pharmaceutical model. These are pot factories that are not designed for patients to be attending in there. And things like security levels, they fluctuate based on how far you are from an urban center. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't just say, okay, and everyone can go in the factory. Those factories were not made for people with a wide spectrum of criminal antecedents going in there, as well as there's quality control issues that, like, the things are supposed to be super sanitized in there, and there's an endless series of SOPs that are supposed to be followed about how clean you keep things and how strict you monitor security. So you can't just take, and there's case law that says this too, you just can't take like a regime and start tweaking, making changes within the regime. You've got to be very sure the changes you're making are what the legislature would have done. And there's no way the parliament intended for people to attend within those stores and obtain their medicine there. So I think it was wrong. Sean didn't get relief on that front. Sean's looking for, I mean, there's things he's not happy about, but he also is glad that, like, his story was told and that some of what we said was recognized as wrong. That really, at the heart of it, Sean said, this system isn't right. And, you know, the thing about this, and these were repealed laws that were challenged, so the government's not obliged to do anything, but all these problems persist today. That the cap on oil strengths, the limits, the two-for-one limits, the in-person, all of that continues today. So, I mean, it's all still broken, but the government's not obliged to fix it. But, I mean, that's a long way of saying Sean's, I guess, has mixed feelings about how things ended up.
And Jack, you were involved with the case too. Do you have any insight into the process that medical patients still have to go through, go to the court to find all these remedies for something that seems like so logical, to be able to buy things in person, have increased strengths to address your particular ailments? I mean, these things are not, it's, they seem to be, to me anyway, no-brainers, but it seems to be very challenging, and having to go to court to constantly challenge the government on these things. What's your take on your experience with Howell and other cases that you've been involved with?
Well, I think that we may see, as a result of the case, an improvement in access. Like, you're starting to see Section 140 of the Federal Cannabis Act used to provide for access in a limited and highly prescribed manner through storefronts. So we may end up, so Paul 1, Howell, and although the judicial remedy may not sort of solve the issue, I think there's a significant chance that the federal government notice and is going to make concessions and amendments that allow for better access. So I'm more hopeful, although, you know, it's, we're, you know, we're still waiting. It's not like Howell just came out. So that's my view. So I think that it certainly created basically what patients have been saying all along, which is like, this isn't working. And so the federal government had, I've frequently said, was sort of gaslighting all of these people, saying, "Oh, you're just whiners." That's my view. I think that we may yet see improvements, although, with the federal government, you just never can tell. But I will say that it was, I think, validating for patients that like the people that Mr. Howell was helping. I think that it was certainly proper validation for them in regards to this, constant position from the federal government that they were, that there was no problem with the program. So what Paul has done with this case is show definitively that every single iteration of the federal medical cannabis program has been found by a court to be unconstitutional, which is like, it's a huge deal. And I think it's important for us to remember in the context of legalization, which is that like the government didn't want to do this. They were dragged kicking and screaming into this situation by cases like Howell.
The medical requirement of cannabis as a medicine that led to the legalization for recreational, you think that's going to be a unique story in the world? Because if you start to, you look south of the border, you see that now there's 17 states as of today, I think, that have legalized for recreational use. It seems that medical seems to be the first conceptually easier way for a government to say, okay, well, it is being used as a medicine. Okay, let's legalize for medical. But then eventually recreational use ends up coming next. Is that the process that we've unearthed here in Canada for the rest of the world? Or what do you guys think?
I'd say yes and no. Like, I mean, in Canada, that was clearly the route it took. Although in the States, I think so I'd say yes as well, in so much as like conceptually, absolutely, it's easier to get your head around someone using it as medicine before you're okay with them using it recreationally. The Americans, I've said what the Americans have, we have the charter, and what the Americans have is their ballot initiatives. And ultimately what really started things, and I think this played a big role in Trudeau's decision to legalize, was Colorado and Washington State winning their ballot initiatives and bringing in rec cannabis. And them doing it, it seemed, I mean, Uruguay, of course, was the very first country to legalize. But I'm not sure it's, always like that. I mean, I look to just looking at other drugs, Portugal, they went, they went decrim like in 2001, and that was for all drugs. And so I'm not sure it's always like that. It can be like that, but I don't think it's always like that. I think there are some places or circumstances in which they just say, you know what, it's not, it doesn't have to be medical. This is just, this is was wrong from the beginning. And the whole drug war, like, of course, it's crazy to have a medicine that's criminalized, but the whole drug war is such a terrible boneheaded failure in so many different ways that I think there's also, aside from the medical angle, a lot of people realizing the drug war has been a terrible failure. And how do we move on from this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what are your beliefs about legalizing or at least decriminalizing all drugs?
Oh, I'm absolutely for that. Like, this is a health issue. It's not a criminal justice issue. All you do is you force people underground by criminalizing it, and so they can't speak openly with their doctor. If there's some other issue going on, if there's domestic violence, but they have a grow, or maybe they have a little meth lab, or maybe they just have some cocaine there. So the woman can't call the police because, so she's forced underground. The whole idea of forcing an industry underground makes everything less safe, and as well as the drugs themselves. Why can't, it should be easy to get it tested. It should be easy to know what's in there to be able to get it from safer supplies. I mean, mm-hmm. we're, of course, and we've seen this with the needle exchanges and safe consumption sites, in which everyone's realizing, well, this seems to be a failure in this regard. And then another group say, it's also a failure in this area. It's really a failure in all areas. It has destroyed families. It's ruined lives. Putting people in jail is not, you don't need to do that if someone has a health issue. And I question too, I think for some people in some circumstances, I'm not even so sure it's a health issue. Maybe it's just a reasonable choice given a very tough circumstances that I don't even know if using various drugs is always the a bad decision. I'm absolutely 100% in favor of removing it from criminal justice.
Hmm. And is that your part of your thrust and expansion of your practice into psychedelics? I mean, both of you are now involved with psychedelics. Is that a way for you to say, hey, you know, this is, I mean, are you moving on to other drugs as well? Or is it cannabis and psychedelics? Maybe frame psychedelics for me.
Well, for me, I mean, it's the research is piling up, and there's sort of a new, there's kind of an increased popularity and interest in psychedelics. People are realizing all the good things that can come from it. And maybe this is happening at the same time that people are waking up to the fact that the drug war is such a failure. So that's kind of why, I mean, there is the beginning, so why am I drawn to it? I guess it's those reasons. It's the increased interest. I'd say the research is increasing. But I mean, really, people have been using these in a safe manner for 70 years. So, it's not really that new. You know, there is, I'll just say this, I'm kind of, it's going off a little bit on a tangent, but as we mentioned psychedelics too, you know, well, you know, I won't go off on too many tangents. I guess that's it for me, those. And I mean, I do have in my heart, I feel like on the opioid issue, I have an interest and a passion for those things. I'm not doing an awful lot actively on that front, but I would do more, I think, if time permitted, in terms of other drugs. So I guess it's a bit of a, the time is right for psychedelics, but I wouldn't rule out doing work to assist with respect to other drugs.
Right. Jack, I think I first heard about your involvement in cannabis but I think when I was trying to or was thinking about becoming a cannabis lawyer, I think it was 2016 or 15. I think the first case about you I heard about was in Hamilton. Were you one of the first lawyers or the first lawyer to obtain a dispensary, so-called dispensary license before it was even possible?
Oh, that's a funny. So I was a baby lawyer that had just been called. Basically, all the other lawyers, I think, were on holiday. So Paul was on holiday, Kirk was on holiday. An injunction was brought against Compassion Club in Hamilton, and so I had to argue it. Of course, I was very junior. And so Paul very kindly took some significant time out of his own family holiday to give me a few pep talks, et cetera. And anyway, I went in and argued it, and we ended up with a municipal injunction that effectively authorized this Compassion Club's operation. I don't want to dive too deep into it because there's still some significant dispute between me and it isn't really dispute, I guess I shouldn't say that, but I wouldn't. Was this just a court order that said that this guy could operate his little Compassion Club, and that order's that was law. A judge is entitled. It was a superior court order, so judge is entitled to make it. but it was a crazy, crazy case. My favorite memory was calling Paul, and he said, "How did it go?" And I think kind of expecting that it was a very bad day for me in court. And then I said, "Oh, I randomly won it." And Paul couldn't stop. I'm sure, was very happy for me. And so from there, so that was just what a fascinating case, and I'm so fortunate to have gotten to work on it. And that court order stood basically from then on until that premises is agreed to shut down in order to become a provincial store with the provincial. Nice. Should be a provincially licensed store. Likely within the next couple of months.
Oh, fantastic. That's such a happy ending.
There are once in a while, there's a good, good ending in the cannabis space.
I would jump in, by the way,
I think that's the only order ever in Canada in which the effectively the authorities were told, don't bust them.
The police were bound by that order. Like, I'm very firm on that. They had a green light from the Superior Court of Ontario to run their Compassion Club, and it bound the police. And that doesn't sound important, but it is, because it's a case of municipal legal issues, right? So if you bind the police in that context, it binds them in the criminal context as well. So it's in my submission, a very significant ruling, and certainly we know it helped a lot of patients access their medical cannabis. It became sort of a real focal point for them, and I agree. I think it's the only time that a case of that nature was went that way. So certainly, I'm very proud of that, and glad that it was able to help the patients that were using that location to access.
Do you remember what the reaction of the judge was to your submissions and your arguing? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to lead into now is, you guys are in court a lot, and what you're arguing typically goes against the more very traditional, as you drug war view of cannabis as an evil substance that must be controlled by criminal law. And so you're going against this these decades of well, for lack of a better word, bamboozlement that judges have, these blinders that they have. What was that judge's particular, why was that judge open to you perhaps? And what, and then I'll follow up with, you know, more questions after that, but what was that judge like for you?
I think Paul, Paul put it best. He said, you know, advocacy comes down sometimes to just making a forceful case to the judge. So like in that circumstance, I argued on behalf of patients and I landed the punch. So he gave them a court order authorizing them to continue accessing their medicine there. And so, you know, I think the most important thing is that the federal, provincial government could have challenged it and sought an amendment to the order in at the Court of Appeal, and they let it stand for 3 years, I suppose, until he agreed to vote in order to seek his provincial license. So, you know, it was the judge made the right decision in my view. I think that he was a supernumerary judge, Justice Loftchick, very well respected judge in Hamilton, and I think that he saw the serious Section 7 issues that were rampant, particularly in Hamilton at that time, and ruled, in my view, correctly that the city's desire to shut them down did not trump the rights of medical cannabis patients.
And when you're in court, do you find that judges and justice of the peace pieces are open to your arguments, and are they and this is a general question, but what is an overall view of the bench in Ontario and maybe in other provinces, but are you noticing change between the era of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act and the Cannabis Act? Is there a change happening? Is there a way that we're moving beyond the criminal into the regulatory, or are we still stuck with a lot of the past?
There's not a lot of rulings on the Cannabis Act. I've got a bunch of sentencing rulings, but even in saying that, like means that I've lost trials and people were convicted or found, at least found guilty of violating the Cannabis Act, which is penal and criminal in nature. So I'm not sure, like we're still using Section 91 sub 27 of the Constitution to, by way of the criminal law head of power, to regulate cannabis in this country. So I think the main difference is the sort of the reasons for legal. Like I frequently argue it should be considered regulatory, but generally all you get is a reduction in sentence on that. So it looks criminal to me. What do you think, Paul?
It looks criminal to me. Ask someone who's sitting in a jail cell because of it, what they think.
Yeah. Yep.
Do you guys predict a change happening, or is it we talking like another decade of this? What's happening with our system here? Are we really legalized? Really, are we not?
Well, we've got a regulatory system that's functioning provincially, and with so like that's in some ways better. Although, like I'm dealing with this regularly now in British Columbia, which is the notice of administrative monetary penalty system that's been introduced there, in which a completely arbitrary assessment of the value of cannabis seized is then used to impose a penalty which is equal to the value calculated by the provincial government times two. So it's basically a double penalty. So you're seeing fines against little compassion clubs run by a family of three people getting fines, upwards of $5 million based on, what I would suggest are dodgy valuations of medical cannabis, et cetera. So in some, like, I guess what I'm saying is you don't always want regulatory law, right? Because right. you're the going rate for that particular situation pre-legalization would have been, you know, discharge. So, you know, in some ways the introducing the regulatory system, and it's, often, immunity from serious charter scrutiny because it's regulatory, like instead of criminal, basically lets the government do even worse stuff to people for interacting with the harmless cannabis plant. So that's my, you know, it's there's good and bad with legalization. There's good and bad.
Mm-hmm. Maybe do you guys have views on the racial inequity of enforcement in Canada and how we can perhaps move to heal that and change that? I mean, I know, you know, the Ontario Human Rights Commission came out with this report last year about the disproportionate number of arrests against Black and people of color in particular with cannabis crimes, even though the rates of use are the same between white people and people of color. And yet here we have this inequity. And I don't know, do you have a way that the governments, provincial and federal governments, could maybe even municipal governments like Toronto could address this and at least look at it, at least, you know, talk about it. I mean, because the reason I'm asking about this is because when I heard that New York was going to legalize, part of their legalization strategy was to earmark funds and offer reparations to people who have been disenfranchised disproportionately by the drug war. And yet nothing in Canada really has happened about with that. Is there, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, like this is how I think it's played out for certain racial minorities is that, like, I don't think they have a whole bunch of, I think there was sort of a, people talk a lot about simple possession charges and I haven't seen the stats, but there's just not a lot of simple possession convictions. The government's been diverting simple possession for at least 20 years. So if you go in there and you've got an eighth or a quarter, you're going to be, or a joint, like you're not going to get a conviction out of it. You're going to write us an essay, or you're going to make a small donation and they'll drop the charge. There's way too much talk about simple possessions and how we have to solve that for the minority, racial minorities. This is how it plays out, in my view, is that if there's cops in some bad part of town and maybe they, it's Jane and Finch and there's some young Black guys hanging out on a corner and they smell some cannabis, they're going to use that as sort of a crowbar to pry open their pockets and their vehicles and maybe their apartments and any backpacks or briefcases they have. So sort of and then if they find something, then they get charged with, like, if it was never about the pot, it's always about a chance to see what's in their pockets or see what's in their vehicle. And that's how it's used. And if it's a bunch of white kids in Forest Hill, they just don't believe they're up to anything. So they're going to say, listen, put away the pot. I don't want that around here. That's what they'll get. That it's, and that's diminished because like it's now, and it hasn't completely gone away because there are ways you can still charge people with simple possession under the Cannabis Act. You could say it's illicit cannabis or that you had it in the place in the car, you shouldn't have it. But it is harder now to search a vehicle or search a person simply based on the smell of cannabis. So if someone, their eyes are clear, they're clearly not impaired, you smell cannabis, and it's not close to the driver, you'd have a very strong charter challenge to have that excluded. Whereas 5 years ago, you would not. So Right. So that it's now, it's less of a tool for the cops than it used to be. I have no doubt they picked on racial minorities in places where they thought they were up to other crimes, but it was never really about the cannabis. But I do think that some form of reparations is a great idea. How many people have had their lives ruined? But I don't think it's someone with a simple possession conviction. It's the person who has their house taken away because they had a few plants in the basement. And mm-hmm. or the person who was sent to jail for a year and was away from his children. And who knows? And everyone knows that jail is just an awful place to be, and it's going to make you, it's like spending a year in a war zone. So, I mean, those are the people who I think reparations should be directed at. I'm sure many are racial minorities, but I kind of don't dig the whole, it's all about the simple possession convictions. And if only we can stop that.
Right. Do you think that the underground market is here to stay forever?
I do. I don't mean to keep jumping in before Jack, but I do think it's
Please.
Here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I do think so.
Me too. I definitely agree. And I think it flows from the definition of illicit cannabis and the potential that, you know, that they could somehow define genetically what is and isn't an acceptable cannabis plant. And I think you get into a situation where, you know, cannabis strains that didn't make it into the legal market maybe never can, right? And then the government calls that a genetic bottleneck, but I call it a recipe for complete and utter destruction of really crucial building blocks for the cannabis community and for the cannabis plant's genetic diversity. So I definitely agree with Paul on that.
And the pricing, you know, like the LPs have to spend so much money to produce cannabis that it's just no way they're going to compete on a price level with the local people. And also there's tons of, there's a lot of allegiance to like black market people kind of have a bit of an allegiance to the black market. And so, it's going to be, it'll take a long time to get rid of, maybe never.
Wasn't there was this effort through the micro licenses to give small producers and processors a way into the industry? Is that not, are you finding that's not a good way for people to go? Or what are your views on that?
No, I think, and like when I mentioned earlier that things are evolving and getting better, I mean, that's one of the ways that it's getting better, that now you don't have to be a billionaire. You could be just a fairly rich guy to, you could get a micro and security requirements are far less and your overall costs are far less. And so that's good. And that's certainly a step in the right direction in which it's gradually becoming easier for everybody to have it. I don't know how many break-ins there have been at LPs. I believe it might be zero. And yet like the level of security is just insane. That's a big part of the reason it's not accessible is the, hyped up security. They're worried about people breaking in, but most of the crimes seem to take place with, people who are already working within there. Russell, I do agree that that's a step in the right direction. It's not like it's not a cure-all, but like that's one of several different things that are happening that are making it less inaccessible, less of a thing that only if you're a billionaire who has never been involved with cannabis could you possibly get an LP? And of course, you know, you can't imagine what a terrible starting place. Like they started it so badly that, I mean, you can only really go in one direction. But that whole idea that if you've ever been involved with cannabis, you can't continue to be involved with cannabis because you must have been black market. So you're not going to pass your security clearance. I can imagine them doing that with any other in the industry. Imagine if they changed dairy farming around. They say, okay, about all the old dairy farmers, you're all black market. We only need only non-dairy farmers can dairy farm from now on. Everyone would say, what? What the heck? So anyway, that's essentially what they did with cannabis in 2013. And they've been slowly undoing it a little, a teeny bit at a time. I don't want to give them too much credit because.
Yeah.
And Jack, I know you were involved with some of the dispensary, you know, obviously the Hamilton medical dispensary, but others as well. What was it like for you to, because this is pre Ontario coming into the, you know, the lottery system and offering now licensing to everyone. When there was this area of time when Prime Minister Trudeau said, okay, we're going to legalize, and then the date of actual legalization, and then the ability to get a license. There was this span of time where all we had in Toronto, more than 100 stores. I don't even know what the count was, but it was definitely, I think it was more than 100 stores. What was that timeline, that time period for you like?
Well, it was a period of great frustration when we thought that we were going to have this horrible LCBO model, it was basically going to be a big fight between the black market operators and the province, as the province basically tried to take it over. When the Ford government said, look, we're privatizing it, if you close the doors and apply, you can have a legal store. And largely they've followed that and been fairly decent about letting people open stores. And so, but it was a busy period, stressful as always, but that's just, you know, that's the job as a lawyer.
I'm going to refresh Jack's memory a little bit, because I think the period Russell's talking about is when Project Claudia first started, which yes. I think was in, there you go, May 2016, I believe.
16. Oh, I may have that's misheard. Right. Sorry, I probably misheard your question. I thought you were asking about something else, I guess. Yeah, I was insanely busy at that time. Project Claudia, oh my goodness.
You were defending some dispensaries in town. And I guess I wanted to bring you back to that really for your busy time. And what was it like, first of all, as a lawyer and as a personal activist, to be helping stores that wanted to be able to sell, but were constantly being arrested and busted by police and municipal licensing standards, and you know, could you help them? Were they beyond help? I mean, and what was it like for you, just as a young lawyer?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Like, it was just criminal defense work. So obviously I wasn't, it would actually be a criminal offense for me if I was helping them to contravene the law. But certainly,
of course.
For me as an activist, it was often hard to see other activists that believed very deeply in the work that they were doing and in sort of fighting the stigma around cannabis and in trying to provide reasonable access to cannabis for a variety of people. So that was always hard. The same as any lawyer, we were fighting to make sure that these accused persons had the best defense that they could have access to. So that was my focus, certainly. I'm not sure if that's a great answer, but
I don't know if you're really giving full justice to how crazy things were back at that time. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I think that summer of 2016, there were a series of huge raids, and like it seemed like almost like every couple days there was another big raid. And
yes,
and there was a kind of like people would come in and they'd want us to act for 10 employees, and that's kind of a tricky thing in terms of conflict right. of interest, and you want to help them all. And And as well, they want to do things in the right way. And they're thinking, is this going to lead to legal? Could I be a legal store when legalization comes if I do this right? And you want to guide them, but you can't guide them. Like, there is a line to draw, because when you go from explaining the law to recommending a course of action that's criminal, then you're a party to the offense. So that was always in our mind. Like, you can't go watch what you say, you got, and how you say it. And whether or not, like, we were, you know, we were doing a lot of that. And I think the authorities, the cops who were doing a lot of this, were aware of us, and maybe we weren't their favorite people.
I used to have a police officer that would follow me around in bail court and listen to me on the phone, which was always cute.
Oh my gosh, come on. Really?
But you know, part of it as well, like, I was agent for a lot of lawyers. So Conroy was counsel of record for a large number of people, and Paul was counsel of record for a large number of people, and Tusa was counsel of record for a large number of people. And so I'd be appearing in court as just as the agent. And, you know, I might be speaking to, like, you know, I think on busy days there might be, like, you know, 100 names on the docket. Wow. So it was a really, really bizarre period. And, you know, I've spoken with lawyers about it. They said that it reminded them of the morality raids in the 80s on the bathhouses. In which you'd have like a large number of people arrested for buggery offenses, who would all be in court. You'd often have like one lawyer there representing 100 different people. So certainly it felt that way for me. So it was, a Crown told me one time, he was laughing and he says, you'll never see this again. He says, for the rest of your career, standing there saying, hi, I'm appearing for these 308 people or whatever. So, so I, but,
I remember an early, one of the early JPTs that I had on a dispensary case, and I was in there for 6 or 7 accused, and the Crown said, no, you're in a conflict. Everyone needs their own lawyer. And so we come back like a month and a half later, and now there's 7 lawyers yelling at him, not one. And then now maybe they did that with a couple of others, but I know their policy changed not long after that. And they said, all right, you can act for a big heap of them. So, I mean, so many of them ended up bonds. So it's not like it ended up a trial.
Yes, that was the remedy, peace bonds. Yes. For our audience, maybe you could tell, what does that mean to give somebody a peace bond at the end of these things?
So it's a promise to the court, which is usually a year in duration. There's common law and Section 810 under the Criminal Code peace bonds. But essentially, it's just a promise to follow certain conditions. And there might be a small monetary penalty if you breach it. And you could potentially be charged with breach of a peace bond. But it's a sweet deal. Anybody who got it, anybody who doesn't want it, was an idiot. So,
right. you guys are also joining forces. You have your independent practices, but you've formed a new law firm. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Paul and I are partners in a law firm with another lawyer named Dan Perlin, and we're called Cannabis and Psychedelics Law Group, LLP. It's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Can you tell me like what the goal of the firm is, and where you see it going in the next, you know, next 5 years?
Go ahead, Jack.
We do regulatory work and a variety of other work in the cannabis and psychedelic sectors, and similar to our cannabis practice, but helping people with a broader array of legal issues. Is that a fair assessment, Paul?
Yeah, it's a little bit more of a business regulatory We also have a business consultant, who Mike Sterogiannis, who's very good. And so it's because so many people are, it's not just cannabis, of course. It's like a lot of people now are trying to get in on the beginning of what's coming in psychedelics. And so like none of that involves going to court. It's all about compliance, as well as business is a big part of it too. So we have people here who have more of a business focus who can advise them. So it's pretty neat to be doing that stuff. I mean, the psychedelic stuff is neat because it's also new. I have to say that.
Excellent. It
does seem exciting.
Right. Yeah, it does. It's very exciting. You know, I look at you guys and I've been trying to you know, there's different images in my mind of either Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or my son, and we've been watching a lot of Star Wars. So I was thinking like Obi-Wan and Anakin, kind of the first trilogy where, you know, pre Darth Vader. You guys are, you know, you're come back to my statement at the beginning of this, is that you guys are real leading edge activists and so great at what you do. I'm very honored you took the time to talk to me today. I have a whole bunch of questions that I didn't even get to. And I'd like to go back in time with you a little bit more to some of the cases. Would you be interested in coming back for another round sometime in the future?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This was really fun. And they were all really neat questions. I mean, it helps that you know this industry too. So I quite enjoyed myself. I'd be happy to. Talking about myself, my favorite subjects. So.
I'm happy to come back as well, man. This was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's great. I love you guys. I hope you have a great day, and we will we'll definitely be in touch. Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Thanks, cool, man.
Okay.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Cannabis Law in Canada. As you may guess, this interview is not legal advice. And if you need legal advice, please contact a lawyer. We're always working on making this the best podcast for our listeners. So if you have suggestions for an interview or ideas for episodes, please contact us at cannabislaw.ca.